资料，仅供沪江研友内部交流，禁止用于商业目的。
Exercise 3. The following questions are based on the radio program about Mother's Day. Listen to the program and then choose the best answer to these questions. You will hear the recording once only. You now have 15 seconds to read the questions.
Good evening and happy Mother's Day weekend. I'm David Truman.
And I'm Linda Wilson. Welcome to the second program in our State of the Union series. Tonight reports on what it's like to be a mum in the 1990s and the results of an important study on motherhood in America.
The first Mother's Day was officially celebrated in West Virginia back in 1908. The home front was different then. Only 5% of all married women worked outside the home. But motherhood wasn't exactly a bowl of cherries. In 1908,Women were still often segregated. Life expectancy was just 54 if you were white, 38 if you were black. And in 1908, moms couldn't vote. A lot has changed since that first Mother's Day nearly 90 years ago.
Today, most moms do work outside the home. In fact, 60% go back before the child is one. So what do women have to say about the state of motherhood today? Well, according to our new national survey, it depends.81% of all women say being a mom is tougher than it was even 20 or 30 years ago, and 56% say today's moms are doing a worse job than their own mothers did.
But when we asked moms if they were personally satisfied with their lives, the overwhelming answer was, you bet.
Yet, there was one message that women in our survey sent loud and clear. Today's moms feel pressed for time. They can't get enough of it.
So, as more moms than ever before head back to work, how well are we adapting?
It's rush hour. Women are hustling back from work. They pick up kids at daycare centers and start the nightside chores amid the children who crave the company. For decades, women have coped with the endless days, letting society postpone the hard work of changing the rules. The reason we are doing it very much the same way as we did more than 20 years ago is simple. Workplaces haven't changed much.School schedules haven't changed much, and the running of the home hasn't changed much either. The philosophy in this country is that they are your children, you decide to have them, they are your problem.
Unit 7, Lectures and Speeches. Exercise 1. You will hear a lecture given by Mr. Elf. He is speaking to a group of students about coffee processing.Listen to it and fill out the table with the information you've heard for questions 1 through 5. Write only one word or number in each numbered box. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the table below.
Hi, I'm Mr. Alf Meerschwam. I'm from a big coffee plant. During this time, I will give you a lecture about coffee processing.First, the coffee beans are usually picked by hand, so that only ripe fruit is collected. Second, the coffee beans are cleaned by the dry process and the wet process, so the dust, pulp, and membranes are taken away from the beans. Third, different types of beans are mixed or blended to give the desired flavor. Next step is roasting. It's the most important step in coffee processing because it develops the typical coffee smell and the flavor.In this step, not to under-roast or over-roast the bean is very important. After roasting, the green coffee beans become brown in color and lose weight. Then, in big processing factories, the roasted coffee beans are first cracked and then cut through steel roller. It's called grinding. Sometimes the coffee is not ground and sold as beans. It's ground then at home by the customer. The last step is packing.Generally, coffee is sold in vacuum-packed or pressure-packed containers so that the flavor isn't lost. Then coffee will be sold at the shop or in the supermarket.
Exercise 2. You will hear a lecture about the uses of computers. For questions 1 through 5, complete the sentences or answer the question while you listen. Use not more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice.You now have 25 seconds to read the sentences and the questions below. We have been discussing how a computer works. Now, let us turn to another topic. What are the uses of the computer? Many laymen have an exaggerated picture of what computers are capable of. Sometimes computers are called electronic brains. And this is confusing because no computer so far built can compete with the human brain in all respects. Let us take a look at the applications of computers in commerce and industry. Today, I shall discuss three of the main areas, and I shall give some examples of each. I think you should note the examples, sir, but don't bother too much about the details of each one. Firstly, clerical work. Computers are very good for handling repetitive clerical work efficiently. We can take two examples of this. The first is the widespread use of computers in handling payrolls, that is, paying employees. I shall spell payrolls for you. That's P-A-Y-R-O-L-L-S, payrolls. Details about each employee, his salary, his tax code, etc., are fed into the computer. The computer makes the necessary calculations and prints out a payslip. Another example of the same sort of process has been the use of computers by banks to provide up-to-date records of clients' accounts. Secondly, we have the use of computers in information systems. The most successful use of these is perhaps the use of computers by airlines to control seat reservation and provide information about flights. British Airways' Boadicea system has 200 terminals in 70 different countries. I'll spell Boadicea for you. B-O-A-D-I-C-E-A, Boadicea. The main computer store for Boadicea has a constant record of the details of every flight, including the number of seats available and the names and passengers who have already booked. Thirdly, the computer as an aid to design planning. My first example has to do with predicting the cost of a design if one were planning to build a road. One could take a series of photographs of the area. From these, the amount of rise and fall of the landscape can be analyzed to within a few inches. This information can be fed into a computer, along with details about what different areas would cost to buy, etc. From all this, the computer can be programmed to work out the cheapest route between two points. My second example has to do with predicting faults in the design. It is possible to produce by computer methods pictures of what the road will look like at 1 meter intervals. It is possible to film each of these as a separate frame and film them in sequence. In this way, one can spot design faults before the actual construction of the road ever begins.
Exercise 3. The following questions are based on a speech about a person who is important in the development of telephones. Listen to it and then choose the best answer to the questions. You will hear the recording once only. You now have 15 seconds to read the questions.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to be here tonight to talk to you about a telephone pioneer, Henry Hunnings. Most people have heard of Alexander Graham Bell, a Scottish immigrant to the United States, who invented the telephone in 1876, but it was a little-known English priest called Henry Hunnings who made the first big improvement. Bell's model could transmit a voice up to about 23 kilometers. A year after its invention, Thomas Edison improved on the model by attaching a solid carbon button inside the mouthpiece. But Hunnings decided to experiment with granular carbon in violation of Bell's patent. This improved the voice clarity and extended the voice transmission distance to about 72 kilometers. Hunnings was granted a British patent for his invention in December 1878. Hunnings was born in 1843 near London. He became a priest in Yorkshire, and although much of his time was taken up with church matters, he had a profound interest in all sorts of gadgets, particularly those that dealt with magnetism and electricity. A friend of Hunnings with similar interests, called Cox Walker, built a telephone receiver. In 1880, an American called Anders visited England and asked Walker to make telephones in England. He was impressed and offered £1,000 for the patent. The offer was accepted, and the Globe Company was formed. Later, it only partially succeeded. In 1881, Hunnings was granted 2 patents in the United States for his invention. But by this time, so many people and companies were involved in telephone design and manufacture that conflict resulted. There was a famous court case in 1882 when the United Telephone Company, owner of the Bell and Edison patents, took the Globe Company to court for an alleged infringement of its patents. At first, it failed to have the Hunnings patent declared invalid, which few people had known about. It then bought the rights to the entire patent from Hunnings. At the time, Hunnings was working near Leeds in the north of England. He later moved south to try and improve his health, but died in 1886 at the age of 43.
Section 4. Simulated Test. Test 1. Section 1. Listening Comprehension. Directions. This section is designed to test your ability to understand spoken English. You will hear a selection of recorded materials, and you must answer the questions that accompany them. There are three parts in this section, Part A, Part B, and Part C. Remember, while you are doing the test, you should first put down your answers in your test booklet. At the end of the Listening Comprehension section, you will have 5 minutes to transfer all your answers from your test booklet to answer sheet 1. Now look at Part A in your test booklet. Part A. Directions. For questions 1 through 5, you will hear a biographical introduction about Woodworth. While you listen, fill out the table with the information you've heard. Some of the information has been given to you in the table. Write only one word or number in each numbered box. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the table below.
Robert Sessions Woodworth, who was born in 1869 and died in 1962, had a long life and a long distinguished career in psychology. He collaborated early on a book in physiological psychology with Ladd and later produced his own editions. In 1901, he and Thorndike performed a famous experiment on transfer of training, defeating the educational philosophy of formal discipline, by demonstrating that mental skills are not, like muscles, strengthened by training, but that it is only identical elements that are transferred from one learning activity to another. Woodsworth also wrote a widely read history of psychology, that is, contemporary schools of psychology, which he revised later and which came out in a third edition, with Mary Sheehan's co-authorship, shortly after Woodsworth's death. His experimental psychology, first published in 1938, proved to be the standard text in its field for several decades until it was largely replaced by Charles E. Osgood's almost equally monumental book in the same field in the early 1950s. In much of his work, Woodworth's functional orientation led him to what he called a dynamic view, which emphasized the importance of motivation in the understanding of behavior. His systemic book, Dynamic Psychology, published late in his career, was a fitting capstone to his many contributions to his discipline. He was active to the end. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 1 through 5. Now you will hear the recording again. Robert Sessions Woodworth, who was born in 1869 and died in 1962, had a long life and a long distinguished career in psychology. He collaborated early on a book in physiological psychology with Ladd, and later produced his own editions. In 1901, he and Thorndike performed a famous experiment on transfer of training, defeating the educational philosophy of formal discipline, by demonstrating that mental skills are not, like muscles, strengthened by training, but that it is only identical elements that are transferred from one learning activity to another. Woodsworth also wrote a widely read history of psychology, that is, contemporary schools of psychology, which he revised later and which came out in a third edition, with Mary Sheehan's co-authorship, shortly after Woodworth's death. His experimental psychology, first published in 1938, proved to be the standard text in its field for several decades until it was largely replaced by Charles E. Osgood's almost equally monumental book in the same field in the early 1950s. In much of his work, Woodworth's functional orientation led him to what he called a dynamic view, which emphasized the importance of motivation in the understanding of behavior. His systemic book, Dynamic Psychology, published late in his career, was a fitting capstone to his many contributions to his discipline. He was active to the end. You now have 20 seconds to check your answers to questions 1 through 5. That is the end of Part A.
Part B. Directions. For questions 6 through 10, you'll hear an interview with a sociologist about job stereotypes. While you listen, complete the sentences or answer the questions. Use not more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the sentences and questions below.
Well, we heard some people just now who seem to feel that other people have a wrong idea about the work they do. Do you think this sort of thing is very widespread?
Absolutely. Most jobs or professions seem to have an image or a stereotype attached to them, often much to the irritation of the job holders. But there is a serious point to all this, too, that maybe young people actually choose their careers under the influence of these false images. And certainly there is evidence that they may even avoid certain careers because they have a negative image.
You say there's evidence?
Oh, most definitely. There was a survey recently into children's attitudes to different professions.
How was that done, though? Because, after all, children don't know much about the world of work before they get into it.
Well, exactly. What the investigators wanted to get at was their impressions and their prejudices. They used a very simple technique. They gave the children 12 pairs of statements. In each pair, one statement was positive. The other was its opposite.
For example?
Well, for example, such and such a person is likely to be boring or interesting company.
I see. What professions did they ask about?
Do you want the whole list?
Well, why not?
Okay, here goes. They looked at physicists, lawyers, engineers, sales representatives, estate agents, economists, accountants, and biologists.
And the results?
Well, they were rather striking concerning one profession in particular. The poor old engineer. Of all the jobs mentioned, he came out really much worse than you might expect. The vast majority of children thought that engineering was a dirty job. They also thought the job was of low status and subordinate. That is, the engineer is more likely to take orders than to give them. Oh, and insecure too. But I must say there were good points too. Engineering was seen to be interesting, well-paid work.
Not such a rosy picture, really.
No, but it got better when the children were asked about how they imagined the engineer as a person. The majority of the children chose positive comments, except that they thought the engineer was likely to be badly rather than well-dressed.
You now have 50 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 through 10. Now you will hear the recording again. Well, we heard some people just now who seem to feel that other people have a wrong idea about the work they do. Do you think this sort of thing is very widespread?
Absolutely. Most jobs or professions seem to have an image or a stereotype attached to them, often much to the irritation of the job holders. But there is a serious point to all this, too. That maybe young people actually choose their careers under the influence of these false images. And certainly there is evidence that they may even avoid certain careers because they have a negative image.
You say there's evidence?
Oh, most definitely. There was a survey recently into children's attitudes to different professions.
How was that done, though? Because, after all, children don't know much about the world of work before they get into it.
Well, exactly. What the investigators wanted to get at was their impressions and their prejudices. They used a very simple technique. They gave the children 12 pairs of statements. In each pair, one statement was positive. The other was its opposite.
For example?
Well, for example, such and such a person is likely to be boring or interesting company.
I see. What professions did they ask about?
Do you want the whole list?
Well, why not?
Okay, here goes. They looked at physicists, lawyers, engineers, sales representatives, estate agents, economists, accountants, and biologists.
And the results?
Well, they were rather striking concerning one profession in particular, the poor old engineer. Of all the jobs mentioned, he came out really much worse than you might expect. The vast majority of children thought that engineering was a dirty job. They also thought the job was of low status and subordinate. That is, the engineer is more likely to take orders than to give them. Oh, and insecure too. But I must say there were good points too. Engineering was seen to be interesting, well-paid work.
Not such a rosy picture, really.
No, but it got better when the children were asked about how they imagined the engineer as a person. The majority of the children chose positive comments, except that they thought the engineer was likely to be badly rather than well-dressed.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 through 10. That is the end of Part B. Part C. Directions. You will hear three pieces of recorded material. Before listening to each one, you will have time to read the questions related to it. While listening, answer each question by choosing A, B, C, or D. After listening, you will have time to check your answers. You will hear each piece once only. Questions 11 through 13 are based on a talk about Internet. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 11 through 13. Good morning, everyone. Today I'll talk about the Internet. The Internet is a computer-based worldwide information network. The Internet is composed of a large number of smaller interconnected networks called intranets. These intranets may connect tens, hundreds, or thousands of computers, enabling them to share information with each other and to share various resources such as powerful supercomputers and databases of information. The Internet has made it possible for people over the world to effectively and inexpensively communicate with each other. Unlike traditional broadcasting media such as radio and television, the Internet is a decentralized system. Each connected individual can communicate with anyone else on the Internet, can publish ideas, and can sell products with a minimum overhead cost. In the future, the Internet may have a dramatic impact on higher education and business as more universities offer courses and more companies offer goods and services online. The Internets from which the Internet is composed are usually public access networks, meaning that the resources of the network can be shared with anyone logging onto or accessing the network. Other types of intranets, called intranets, are closed to public use. Intranets are the most common type of computer network used in companies and organizations where it is important to restrict access to the information contained on the network. During the 1990s, the Internet has grown tremendously in the number of people using it and the amount of information contained on it. According to the Internet Society, a nonprofit society that studies and promotes the use of the Internet, 134 countries had full Internet connection, and an additional 52 countries had limited access, for example, email only, in 1996. Some surveys found that as of September 1997, there were between 53 and 57 million users of the Internet worldwide. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 11 through 13.
Questions 14 to 16 are based on a lecture on culture shock. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 14 to 16. Well, I think generally speaking, we could say that there are four stages to culture shock. First of all, the honeymoon stage. To the visitor, everything seems new, quaint, and novel. The food that surrounds the buildings, and it produces a feeling of euphoria, a desire to look around, to experiment, to explore. The next stage is the horror stage, where the newness wears off, and the visitor sees the country from a different light, and often begins to criticize the country, the life, and the values of the people. The next stage, we would say, is the humor stage, where people begin to reflect back and laugh at the mistakes in the earlier stages. And the final stage, we could say, is the home stage where people begin to feel at home, enjoy living in the foreign country. My lecture only highlights certain aspects of culture shock and is not meant to imply that all individuals visiting another country will experience all the stages, or that there is a particular order to culture shock. In addition, culture shock is not limited to the overseas visitors. Rather, it often occurs within cultures as individuals move from place to place or from one setting to another, e.g. from high school to college. Finally, culture shock should be viewed as a natural occurrence affecting most of us to different degrees, and it's nothing we should seek to deny if it happens to us. Just ride it out and enjoy. You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 14 to 16.
Questions 17 to 20 are based on a talk given by a professor. You now have 20 seconds to read questions 17 to 20. Your assignment this term will be to write two major research papers. One of the most important things about writing a research paper is to give proper credit for your sources of information. Failure to do this is called plagiarism, which is a form of intellectual dishonesty. Plagiarism is a kind of stealing, or at least an unauthorized borrowing of someone else's ideas. Sometimes, inexperienced students will plagiarize unintentionally and then be surprised when the teacher won't accept their papers or gives them a failing grade. The best way to avoid unintentional plagiarizing is to be very careful in gathering your information as you take notes on books and magazine articles about the topic you've selected. Firstly, try to assimilate the information thoroughly. Secondly, write it down in your own words. This is called paraphrasing. If you do a good job of paraphrasing, you'll capture the main idea from your source without actually using any phrases from it. Most of your notes should probably be in paraphrases. However, occasionally, you may find something you wish to quote directly in your research paper. In this case, be sure that you copy the quotation precisely in your notes and enclose it in quotation marks. That way, when you are finalizing your research paper, you'll be able to remember which of your notes are direct quotes and which are your own summaries of the material. You can then incorporate them appropriately and give the original author proper credit. You now have 40 seconds to check your answers to questions 17 to 20. That is the end of Part C. You now have 5 minutes to transfer all of your answers from your test booklet to Answer Sheet 1.